Williams College President Emeritus Francis Oakley, author of the new book, From the Cast Iron Shore, will present a book talk and signing on Sunday afternoon from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Clark Art Institute Auditorium. From the Cast Iron Shore, part personal memoir and part participant observer's educational history, details the progression of Williams College from a fraternity-dominated institution in the 1950s to a leading liberal arts college that it is today. Oakley relays his experiences growing up in England, Ireland, and Canada. You can help extract the different parts of his accent. It's really fun. His time as a soldier in the British Army and his years as a student at Yale University, he combines this account with reflections on the social class, the relationship between teaching and research, the shape of American higher education, and the challenge of educational leadership in the late 20th and early 21st century. It is a great pleasure to welcome Frank Oakley to the roundtable this morning. How are you, sir?
Very well, thank you. Delighted to be here.
It's a great pleasure to have you on the program. Give us an idea of the, just real quick, the years of which you were president of the college.
From 85 to beginning of 94.
And how do you look at that in the scope of your career, of those years at Williams, of what you were able to do, to accomplish, and I mean, is that the pinnacle of your educational career, do you think?
Well, I have two sort of careers. My primary calling is historian, teacher, researcher, writer.
Right.
But in the Williams scheme of things, faculty rotate through some of the senior positions, administrative positions. So in terms of administration, yes, it was the peak moment of stress and everything else.
it seems, I mean, the joke, as you know all too well, you know, the joke in academia is that, you know, you sit down with your colleagues, you play a card game, whoever loses, they become the chair of whatever.
Right. Good academic type joke.
So, but what did you enjoy about it? And ultimately, as you detail in the book, of what you learned, because it seems you learned so much about academia through that pursuit.
Yes. Well, I'd been dean of the faculty for nearly 8 years before I became president. It's a very interesting job. The range of the presidency now, the range of things you're called upon to deal with is very, very broad, from very basic things like renovation of buildings through to high intellectual things. So it's a very stimulating, and I found very fulfilling job, high pressure. Yeah.
How do you feel, I mean, one of the themes in the book, as I mentioned in the introduction, is looking at the progression of the college. Where did you come in that progression?
Well, I started teaching then in 61. So that was the old Williams, the old fraternity male college with only about 1,100 students. My first job was at Yale, first full-time job. So basically, I spent several years struggling for survival as a young chap starting out, teaching a range of courses and raising a family. We have four children. Then gradually got caught up in a governance of the college. These small places are fascinating places if you're institutionally oriented. I am.
Yes.
I found out. So it's in the late 60s I really got deeply involved in the governance of the place, of a tough time for the country at large, but also for educational institutions. And then on again into the 70s and dean of the faculty, and then on into the presidency. So I was there basically throughout 30-plus years when the place was transformed, beginning with Jack Sawyers, the president who came in 61 and faced the whole issue of fraternities and so on, co-education, major changes.
And obviously this was happening in other campuses
yes.
as well. But to see it happen before you and have to make those decisions and really be on the front lines of it, right? I mean, of making decisions that would affect ultimately not just the campus at Williams, but academia as a whole.
Yes. Well, it's very interesting, of course, to have lived through those years. If it were the 30s, things would have been a lot quieter. Or even the years after I stepped down as the president, it became student activism faded away after years of it. And it became quieter again. But those years were extremely stimulating and interesting issues and important issues. So I feel privileged to have gone through that.
What was your feeling about, take them as two separate issues, but obviously fraternities, of how you felt, their role in a campus and taking that away from, of what that does, and then obviously also broadening the educational base to more than one gender.
Yes, and more than one race.
Correct.
Yes. Oh, well, tell you the truth, when I got there, you know, I'm an import. I knew nothing about fraternities. I had very little idea, and I was preoccupied with little children and getting my feet on the ground. Clearly a crucially important change, and it was a clean change in the sense that they were abolished in the end, finally in 68, but beginning in 62, the transition. And they had been particularly powerful at Williams. 80% of the student population had been in fraternities. And listening to my senior colleagues talk, as I did, it was clear that they had a negative effect on the intellectual vibrancy of the place, apart from messy issues about how people were selected. And some of them belonged to national fraternal groups, so the worries about anti-Semitism, worries about racial bias, and so on. And I think the fact that Williams dealt with that before becoming a coeducational institution was very important for the smoothness of that transition.
What fascinates me in reading your book and in reading about the subject that obviously there are universities, there are colleges that are still dealing with this issue.
Oh yes.
And it's you were dealing with it in the 60s and 70s, and yet it's still being dealt with. Why do you think there has been a hesitation to do what Williams did and just to remove it from the equation?
Well, I think you have to distinguish between the bigger and the smaller places. I think if you're a huge university, fraternities may play a rather positive part in the life of some of the students. They'd be lost without them. Not always positive, but that there is a positive side to it. The smaller places, they were so dominant in the way they would not be at a large university that they penetrated into the very fabric of the place in ways that were, I had some positive sides. I mean, I had students who were furious when fraternities were phased out. And for them, it had been a very important experience, particularly kids who came from places like Montana or whatnot, and were having to make a very complex adjustment to a New England institution like Williams. They were helped by it. But smaller places, I think, fraternities were more damaging than at the larger places.
When you think about, let's look at the subtitle of the book, which is "In Lifelong Pursuit of Liberal Learning." What does that mean for you? What does liberal learning mean to you?
Well, the broad array of arts and humanities, normally grouped under the arts and sciences, at at places. That's what I mean. And not in any way precisely pre-vocational or pre-professional. That seems to me is the big divide. There's a lot of arguments about the humanities nowadays. I don't see that as the issue. I see the growth or the looming importance of pre-vocational, pre-professional education at the undergraduate level. That's one set of things as opposed to what I call liberal learning, the arts and the humanities and the natural sciences, just as intellectual pursuits.
But it's ultimately a balanced education, right? I mean, it's to get your feet wet in many different things and to learn have a contextual education.
Yes, all of that. All of that. I'm a true believer in that.
And yet that is often questioned and is sometimes there seems to be, obviously you know this much better than I do, but there seems to be where the tail wags the dog, where the student says, yeah, okay, but I don't like that.
I don't quite get.
Meaning that the student will often say, okay, but I'm going to take what I want to take as opposed to what perhaps I should take.
Well, that's true. But they may want to take things that are, in economic terms, useless. Which a sort of place provides the occasion to do. I have a granddaughter now at Williams, and she wants to be a philosophy major, and happily her parents are understanding, you know. It's the range of things, it's more of a preparation for a long life than a preparation for any, obviously, specific career. And a broad array of things, I think, is terribly important for living.
Mm. Your book, and we'll end with this, but your book does not seem to be a hand-wringing about education. You seem optimistic.
I am. Yes. No, I'm not hand-wringing type. Yes, you know, if you know something about the history, it's gone up and down. We've had crises. You've had periods when the higher education was sharply attacked, the earlier part of this century, as well as clearly in the 80s, when the culture wars, so-called, prevailed. Yes, no, I think the realities on the ground are more encouraging than the broad theoretical statements made against them.
Well, Williams College President Emeritus Francis Oakley is the author of the new book, From the Cast Iron Shore, In Lifelong Pursuit of Liberal Learning. The book is published by Notre Dame. He's going to be presenting a book talk, free book talk, and signing on Sunday afternoon from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Clark Art Institute Auditorium in Williamstown. You can find out more information by going to clarkart.edu. Frank Oakley, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.